Access number 27091, Mr. Ken Bean, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about your time in Japan. You were working, or rather not working, from the sound of it, in the British Embassy at Tokyo for a while. Anything else about that time before you... Did you rejoin your ship? What was the next thing that happened?
Yes, I did. The items I've mentioned, I think, were really the principal highlights of the stay in the British Embassy. I know we did walk around the city, and there were some of the places which had not been affected by the aerial bombardment, notably the Diet, I think it is, which was the Emperor's Palace. I think the Americans decided they were looking forward to the post-war period. They decided that they would leave that intact, and certainly it was. But I did rejoin the Tyne after whether this was 3 or 4 weeks. And by this time, demobilization had got underway. I can remember some of my shipmates who'd been in the Navy longer than I had were groups 21 and 22, which was very low. And they began to go, but very soon the numbers for demobilization moved forward rapidly. My demobilization number was 52, and I don't again remember precisely how long it was, but I did, in a matter of a few weeks, which I was again spent on the Tyne, get a draft back to the United Kingdom.
How did you get back?
I came back in stages. The first part of the journey was on taking passage on a ship called the Ariadne, which was a mine-laying cruiser. There were a few of these in the Navy, very fast ships. They made about 40 knots. And I took passage on the Ariadne, by which I mean I was not ship's company, from Tokyo to Shanghai. I have the fortune of being generally what's regarded as a good sailor, and the only occasion I've ever felt mildly seasick, and it didn't last for very long, was in the Sea of Japan on board the Ariadne. Our quarters, I know, were in the stern of the ship, through which the mine rail ran when the ship was actually laying mines. And on that occasion, I know the ship developed a bit of a corkscrew motion, which was due to a quartering sea, but it passed off and I was okay. We arrived in Shanghai as the first port of call, and I went ashore there. I think we stayed overnight. I seem to remember I got mild infection of some sort there, a flu type thing. But I can remember Shanghai and the Yellow River, I suppose it is, and the swords which were sold on the main street, said to be made in Birmingham. I don't know whether that's true or not. But didn't stay very long in Shanghai, and then continued on board Ariadne to Hong Kong, where I spent, I suppose, a few days. I left Ariadne and I suppose my quarters were then on a New Zealand passenger ship which had been turned into a hospital ship during the war, called the Orangi, spelt I haven't written it down, but it's is it essential to know? Perhaps not. During the time I was in Hong Kong, again a place which I don't think bears much resemblance to its modern day form, I did see one interesting thing. The peak is a feature of Hong Kong, which obviously still exists today, and I suppose it may still be true, as was in those days, or in the pre-war days, that if you were resident in Hong Kong, the higher up the peak you lived, the higher up your bungalow you were, the more affluent you were. When the Japanese took Hong Kong, they made the British prisoners of war build a monument to the Japanese dead that had fallen in taking it. And I think one of the first things the British forces did when they retook Hong Kong was to blow this monument up. But I did go up to the peak and see where this was. I don't have much other recollection of Hong Kong except the humour of the Chinese boat population, which were all around the harbour and Kowloon. They seemed to be extremely happy people who did all the washing or dobing, as we used to say, for the ship's company or anyone who wanted their services. But from Hong Kong, I took the final passage home, but I must say at this stage that I've missed out one, and I didn't intend to miss it out, one important aspect of this journey back to the United Kingdom, which goes back to my passage on the Ariadne. I'd forgotten that when we left Tokyo, and I don't know whether you can put this in better order, we did pay a quick visit to the what had been the Japanese naval port of Kure. And Kure is in fact about 10, 15 miles distant from Hiroshima. Surprisingly, at that time the railway services were in order. This was 4 months after the atomic bomb had been dropped. And again, with a shipmate, I can't remember who he was at this time, I took a train to Hiroshima and arrived there in a station which had been sort of partially rebuilt. My recollections of Hiroshima are quite clear now. I've seen pictures in the newspaper, obviously, at the time, but it was exactly as you see it in these news, in these photographs of the time. A city that stood, as it were, on a plain with mountains all around. And it was a total area of absolute devastation. There were, in what I suppose had been the city centre, still some buildings standing, and these had been clearly those built of brick and stone. And that was the only place I ever saw any hostility shown towards the British forces. A Japanese raised his fist at me. We never thought in those days about, we knew little about radiation, and I suppose, although it was 4 months after the bomb was dropped, probably the radioactivity was a bit higher than perhaps would be regarded as normal, but I'm still here to tell the tale, so it couldn't have done too much harm. And I didn't mean to miss that out, but the Japanese were industrious, and I know they obviously still are industrious people, and even at that time they had started to rebuild timber shacks around the area, particularly of the railway station. So that took place actually before I went continued on to Shanghai and Hong Kong. So I coming really towards the end of my story of naval service.
Now, what was the trip back on the Arangi?
I didn't come back. I came back. The Arangi was merely a hospital ship, and again I lived on quite relative comfort there because it was a passenger vessel, a merchant ship, and I lived in a on board and had my meals in a what had been a no doubt possibly the second class saloon, but waited on by Lascar. I think they were Lascar seamen or waiters. But that didn't last very long, and I took passage on board what had been, I think we call them the banana boats, the converted aircraft carriers of a ship called the Raja, which was an American ship. And we left Hong Kong, didn't go back as I'd been hoping through the long way around, through around Australia, but went back through via Singapore. We didn't go ashore at Singapore. We merely laid in the roads, as they're known, Singapore roads, for overnight, and then continued. And I think when I came back, the only places I stopped again were the ones I'd stopped on the way out, namely Colombo.
And this is January to February 46, would it
this
be?
Would have been this would have been in February to March 46, because I got back to the United Kingdom in March. Yes, stops were made at Aden and Port Said, and I think Gibraltar. And I don't honestly remember going ashore at Gibraltar. And finally, Devonport and Portsmouth. That trip back was fairly uneventful. Again, passage through the Bay of Biscay was a bit more exciting than the one out. I think we came through the tail end of a storm, but as I say, I was a good sailor, never affected by seasickness, and I had a camp bed which I had positioned right in the forepeak of the ship, and going through the Bay of Biscay was like going up and down in a lift, but didn't seem to bother me.
When you got back, were you demobilised straight away?
Pretty well, yes. And I have to say, this was in March of 1946, and to some extent, I don't know that I'd have sort of admitted this freely at the time when I came home, I wasn't terribly overjoyed to come home. Well, I don't mean to say that's perhaps not quite true, obviously part of me was, but the adventure in a sense was over, and England looked very much as it had done before the war when I got back in 1944. It still looked pretty war-torn. I went back to Collingwood, and demobilisation was fairly quick, really. I was lucky in the sense that many people in the other services in my group were not demobilised so quickly.
What were you going to do? I mean, you know, what did you decide to do? You know, you're coming out of the Navy, quite a time in it. What were you going to do?
I think I suffered from feelings that many people had, that they didn't really know what they wanted to do. I didn't particularly want to go back to the clerical job that I'd had before the war. I think the last job I'd had been with the Inland Revenue, and I didn't find that really very exciting. What I did for a short time was, although I didn't really see my future in the electrical industry or in the radio industry, I was still quite interested in radio, and I did think about further education. But you may remember that I'd said that when I was at school, I was a bit of a inconsistent in that I was good at some science subjects but not so good at others, and I felt that if I took up study for electrical engineers, I'd find some gaps that would be hard to close. But nevertheless, I did, while I was thinking about what I might do, I did get a job through a friend of mine working for the London County Council in a department, a schools department, which actually looked after schools, cinematograph and wireless equipment. So I was doing much the same thing. In fact, was a bit more employed than I'd been perhaps in my time in the Navy. But I decided really that what I wanted to do was perhaps to complete my education. I'd not taken a degree at school, or rather I'd not gone on to university because of the war. And there were opportunities with government grants for further study, So I applied for a grant, and I did obtain one, and I went on to do economics as a degree subject externally in London University. But as far as the
And what job did you go to after that to get you settled back into civilian life?
I went into insurance. I joined an insurance company for which I, in fact, worked 40 years, or best part of 40 years. My father had been in the insurance business, but I went into more general insurance in the city in London, and I gravitated through the ranks, as it were, of the company.
Now, what about what your service had done for you, physically, mentally, good or bad, as far as you were concerned?
Well, I suppose I'd grown up in the forces. It had changed my life in a way that I don't suppose a similar 4 years in civilian life would have done. I'd travelled, obviously. It hadn't made me, I suppose, terribly restless. I'd obviously enjoyed myself in Australia, but I suppose the pulls of home, once I got home, were really always going to keep me here. I did feel, you know, as far as the general time was concerned, that since in the years more recently, I suppose, I've read much more about the activities of the Navy in the Pacific area, and it's always been a matter of some disappointment to me that the Royal Navy, which assembled the largest fleet it ever did, let alone the fleet train, was not properly recognised. I think the Americans recognised it, and they did come to regard the efforts of the British Navy, the Royal Navy, in the latter stages of the war as very notable. I mean, I think they admired the way our ships were built, and the British ships, British aircraft carriers, didn't suffer because of their steel decks in the way the American one did from the kamikaze attacks. But in fact, they talked about they talk freely even today about the Forgotten Army, the 14th Army in Burma. But the British Pacific Fleet really was the Forgotten Fleet. In fact, there was a well-known writer who wrote a book called The Forgotten Fleet. And he probably exists still today, but two or three years ago, when my wife and I went down to Portsmouth, in the dockyard, in the museum there is a whole area given over to the British Pacific Fleet of 1944-45, and it is called the Forgotten Fleet.
Thank you very much.